This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, this is the Bite Size Business Breakfast for Wednesday, the 24th of August. Slightly jet-lagged morning for a couple of us, but lots to keep us busy. That includes speaking to Jacqueline Joost, who is the head of a new sustainable travel forum. Ironically, it's called Ecomatic. It's getting ready for its global launch, but Jacqueline has just relocated herself to Dubai. We are going to find out why a little bit later in this podcast. Plus, we've been looking at acquisitions, Husby acquiring not one but two mortgage-related companies. We've been speaking to Anna Monterio, the general manager of mortgages, about that. Meanwhile, Ed Bell, economist and commodities expert from Emirates NBD, has been in the hot seat this morning as oil crossed $100 a barrel again during the show. We've found out why, plus what those Saudi comments about potential OPEC cuts could mean for us. Plus, we have been talking whistleblowers this morning. Is Elon Musk going to get a little bit of help from an unlikely source when it comes to getting out of his $44 billion Twitter deal? All of that, plus Richard and I just happy to be back together again. Where we are flicking through the international papers, let's talk about employees, past and maybe past. Let's start with Twitter.
Right. This is the latest chapter in Elon Musk's takeover spat with Twitter. A former Twitter security chief, front page of the Financial Times this morning, has claimed that Twitter misled US regulators over a couple of things. Number one, its cybersecurity defenses. But number two, and most importantly to Mr. Musk, fake accounts. And the FT says these are allegations that threaten to hamper Twitter's legal effort to force Elon Musk to go through with his $44 billion buyout deal. So who is this guy? Well, he's known in cybersecurity circles as Mudge, real name Peter Zatko. And he was fired by Twitter at the beginning of this year. He'd only been at the company about 18 months. He was brought in by Jack Dorsey in 2020, when Jack Dorsey was still the chief executive of Twitter, in the wake of a major and embarrassing hack on the company in the summer of 2020, just as the pandemic was getting going. Now, the FT quotes an organization called Whistleblower Aid. Never heard of them, do you?
Nope, never.
But they are a non-profit legal group, and they're representing Mr. Zatko. They last month filed a complaint to the regulators, the US Securities and Exchange Commission, to the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, as well as members of Congress. So they're really going for it here. I mean, you don't want those guys on your back. The SEC, the Department of Justice, et al. The specific allegation is that Twitter violated an agreement regarding cybersecurity precautions, also accused the company of deception around the detection and deletion of fake or spam accounts, including those that may have been used for foreign interference or misinformation. Of course, it's bots, isn't it, or fake accounts that are the main reason Elon Musk is citing for pulling out of his $44 billion bid. This is not game, set and match to Elon, but it does look like a good score for him, does it not?
Yeah, look, it does. And they've subpoenaed the whistleblower, haven't they, already?
Yesterday's story was that Musk had subpoenaed Jack Dorsey to speak. And it's a related issue because what he's asked Jack Dorsey to do, who was, of course, the former CEO of Twitter, is to... He subpoenaed not just Jack, but also, if I'm right, his confidential correspondence with other Twitter executives on this issue over the past couple of years. So Jack Dorsey will have to have his day in court and under oath will have to swear that there weren't confidential conversations about fake bots and there wasn't a cover-up.
Yeah, I'm looking at Sky News in the last couple of hours is reporting that, yes, as well as the subpoena for Jack Dorsey, a subpoena has been issued to Mr. Zatko as well. Elon Musk's lawyer saying in a statement, "We found his exit and that of other key employees curious in light of what we have been finding."
Twitter, of course, has a different take on this. They said Mr. Zatko was dismissed because of ineffective leadership and poor performance. And they went on to say, repeating their mantra, "What we've seen so far is a false narrative about Twitter and our privacy and data security practices that is riddled with inconsistencies and inaccuracies."
Yeah, so there you go. Stay tuned for tomorrow's exciting episode of the Twitter Wars, because there will almost certainly be more. Now, we are going to be talking about employees a little bit later in the show. 7:30, we're going to be speaking to Anreg Bala, who is co-founder and chief revenue officer of a company called Outsized. We're speaking to him because they have a survey suggesting that regional companies are increasingly turning to not just freelance employees, but using consultants in place of their own staff. Now, we are no shortage in this region to a consultancy culture, aren't we? A lot of blue suits, brown shoes, hopping onto planes across the Gulf of a Monday or a Sunday morning, depending on where they are consulting to. But adding to that, we also have a Harris poll that's been done for Bloomberg about who is holding all of the cards when it comes to hiring. In the Great Resignation, we have heard, as indeed I did in France just a couple of days ago, of the interviewees really having the upper hand in interviews. One hotelier told me they're asking us the questions rather than the other way around. But this Harris poll for Bloomberg suggests that that might be shifting. Just over half, 58% of respondents, saying that they believe companies have more leverage in the job market. That's gone up 5 percentage points from January. This is a survey they have done before, showing a bit of a change in sentiment. The hot labour market, the tight labour market, we've spoken about a huge amount on this show. It's one of the reasons that the Fed feels, I speak for the Fed, they're doing their own speaking a little bit later today. Maybe we should listen to what Jed Powell has to say in Jackson Hole first. But it's thought to be one of the reasons that the Fed is quite hawkish, that it feels okay about raising interest rates at the moment, because we don't have, whilst we do have the runaway inflation around the world, we've also got quite strong jobs markets. So we don't necessarily have the unemployment that would worry people going along with that. But we are hearing every day of big layoffs from big companies. And even though the US economy added double the number of jobs that people thought it was going to last month, and the unemployment numbers are still looking good, there is concern about where that leverage is. And maybe you're not feeling so bullish about quitting your job at the moment if you hear that other big companies, your potential new employers, are starting to lay people off.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. I mean, the mood and the wind can change quite quickly, can't they? And, you know, 1 month you've got four different interviews and you're playing them off against each other. And the next month you've, you know, three of those offers have been withdrawn and, you know, you're backtracking humbly in the fourth one that still has an offer. And that's to an extent been a story as old as time. It's just amplified at the moment, isn't it? The whole Great Resignation, you know. Well, let's not forget April, May, June 2020, looking at those US jobs numbers, the US was shedding about 10 million jobs. So clearly there, the employees were in a dreadful situation. And then within 18 months, you know, within a year, it had flipped 180, hadn't it? I mean, you were in Florida when, in 2021, was it August this time last year?
It was, yeah, it would have been July, August.
July, August, yeah. So, you know, literally July 2020, if you worked in the hospitality industry, you were out of a job and broke. Within 12 months, you know, both you and Tom and many others who were there, and you were both in Florida and elsewhere, and it was the help wanted signs out and you couldn't get anyone. So it flipped very quickly in favour of the employees. Maybe the pendulum is swinging back toward the employers now.
Yep, Ford is the company making headlines this morning that it's going to cut 3,000 jobs, largely thought to be in North America. 2,000 of those expected to be what they call salaried jobs as opposed to agency jobs, so full-time employees. It's part of the shift to electronic vehicles, they're saying, rather than it being an economic thing. They say that basically they need to reshape everything that they have been doing for the last century in order to make electronic vehicles.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Well, we are very pleased to be joined this morning on Microsoft Teams by Ian Beattie, Senior Director of Market Economics and Commodities Expert, Ed Bell. Ed, good morning. Thanks for speaking to us.
Good morning, Brandy.
And nice timing, just giving the oil price there. We're talking to you about commodities this morning on the back of one of our headlines. The Saudi Arabian energy minister giving a little bit of a warning that OPEC could reduce production to counteract price falls. So let's start there. A bit of background, actually. Even though oil has risen this morning, what pushed it back under $100 in the first place?
Yeah, we had some pretty heavy selling over the last few weeks, I think, as oil markets really got caught up into the kind of global recession narrative. And largely that started to come to fruition seemingly from the data where we're seeing PMI numbers from the US, from the Eurozone looking quite poor in recent prints. We've had two GDP prints in the United States that have been contractionary. So all of that is not very good mood music for commodities in general and for oil prices, which had run up so significantly in the last, the second quarter. There has been some adjustment downwards, although we are seemingly stabilizing in the Brent market at just around that $100 barrel, sort of plus or minus $5 on either side.
So what do you make of the comments coming out of Saudi Arabia that OPEC could cut production, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, if prices continue to fall? A lot of people are going to be looking at $97, $98, $99 a barrel and thinking it's not exactly cheap.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't think that oil prices at, you know, $90 a barrel are going to be much relief to any kind of consumer in the market when general prices are rising, when interest rates are going up as well. I think what to take from the oil minister's comments, though, there were some interesting nuggets there. So one, this kind of saying that oil prices falling is volatility. I don't know that that's quite fair for consumers because they could easily say that oil price is rising. OPEC might say that's a stable oil market, but that's not what consumers might think. But one thing to point out, though, is the relative disconnect between, to get a bit technical and jargony, the physical and the futures market. So the paper market or the futures market, which is what most of us refer to when we talk about the oil price, that's seen a lot of the downward movement. But when we look at the physical market, so what the actual traders are buying and selling cargoes of oil or other oil products for delivery, what oil producing companies are actually receiving, that's still pointing to a much tighter market. So those prices have not changed as significantly as the oil futures market. So that kind of disconnect does suggest that there's some inconsistencies and irregularities in the market. Nothing to say that there's anything, you know, any kind of shenanigans behind that. But still, it's a matter of which one do you think is more true? And I think most people operating in the physical market would say that those prices are actually what's real, because that's actually what people would have to pay through the entire oil supply chain.
So what could this actually mean for prices, Ed, and for production? Because before I went on holiday, we were asking how much oil there actually was to pump at the moment.
Sure. So I think we've already seen a reaction positively in prices to the oil minister's comments. We had about a 4% gain in Brent and WTI overnight. And as you say, closing above $100 a barrel, I think that was the first close since about the start of August that the Brent market got back up $100 a barrel. So it could be that that's the kind of floor or the minimum that OPEC Plus wants to keep. So perhaps you get some more verbal intervention when prices start to dip substantially below that. In terms of what happens actually with production, though, you know, we've already gotten to the point where OPEC Plus probably can't meet the production targets that it has been setting. They've already been failing to hit them. So the moderate increases that we have for September or planned onwards are probably going to be even that much more out of reach. So sort of on paper or in words, they could basically say, well, we're actually going to pull those back and they're not going to hit them. But that's probably not going to change the dynamics of the market very much, given that they were probably unachievable targets to hit anyway.
Well, at the same time, we've got Gazprom announcing a 3-day maintenance shutdown for Nord Stream 1, the pipeline. What does that mean for the European economy and for gas prices?
Yeah, we've seen a very substantial spike in gas prices in Europe in the last week on the back of that announcement. Gas supplies to the European economy from Russia are already being disrupted because of these maintenance issues or the sort of tit-for-tat of sanctions that have been imposed by the EU on Russia in response to the war in Ukraine. And now there's a fear that those volumes could drop even further at the end of the month when this maintenance period is supposedly underway. I think we're seeing a really sharp reaction beyond commodity markets in European assets generally, as the outlook for the Eurozone economy and for the UK as well, getting sort of sucked into that, is increasingly looking more and more dark. So we've actually had the euro fall below parity, so below one against the US dollar, actually at its lowest level in 20 years, as it does look like the way that Europe is going to adjust to those lower volumes of gas coming through is through demand adjustment. So that's going to mean slower industrial output or contraction in industrial output, consumers not going out and buying as much. We've seen announcements from Germany, for instance, that they're going to impose an additional levy on consumers if they use too much gas. So that's going to be that much less disposable income available to consumers to go out and support their economy. Hence, it's all weighing on European assets.
Is this just a story, though, of euro weakness, or is it also a story of dollar strength? Because we have seen other currencies fall against the dollar.
Yeah, I think we had very much a dollar strength story for the early parts of this year, but now the kind of endemic weakness in the Eurozone economy is starting to accelerate the weakness in the euro, pushing it lower. But as you say, we're also seeing movements lower in sterling, so falling and holding well below the 120 level, kind of at the 117, 118 level, as the economic outlook in the UK likewise looks pretty tough. You have supply chain disruptions, labor shortages, very high inflation there. Some warnings from the Bank of England that we could get up to 13% inflation in the UK. So there are some specific UK economy issues that are also dragging down that currency. Likewise in Japan, it's really a case of which country can you point to that's actually doing quite well? And unfortunately, there's not very many in this stage or at this stage in the cycle of the global economy.
What does that increasing dollar strength mean for the UAE? We get a better deal if we go overseas, European shopping holidays, for example. But what does it mean for us, both exports outwards and people inwards?
Sure. It provides a relative amount of insulation against higher input costs, given that we are, you know, not quite a dollarized economy, but we have a very strong link to the U.S. monetary policy. So the dirham appreciates basically on a like-for-like basis, as does the dollar against these other currencies. So the dirham purchasing power, as you say, when you go out into Europe or to the U.K. or to the other economies, could feel that much better, although having just come back from a European holiday, the fact that inflation is so high in those countries is eroding that additional competitiveness. For the export side, it does also make the UAE relatively more expensive, whether that is for exports of commodities coming out of or services coming out of the country, makes it that much more expensive for tourism coming into the UAE as well. So it's a sort of a double-edged sword in that we are somewhat protected against the importing inflation from the rest of the world because we have a relatively strong currency against other exporting markets, but also we become a relatively more expensive destination for people choosing to avail of the UAE services.
Ed Bell, thank you very much for your time this morning. Emirates NBD Senior Director of Market Economics and Commodities Expert speaking to us about the rise in oil prices this morning and that upcoming maintenance shutdown of the Nord Stream 1 gas pipeline into Europe.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
Right, let's talk tech takeovers now, because Dubai-based prop tech startup Husby has acquired a couple of mortgage brokers, Just Mortgages and Finance Lab. Joining us in the studio to give us some more context is the General Manager for Mortgages at Husby, Anna Montero. Anna, good to have you with us. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. So kind of two stories for the price of one. A few months ago, Husby, which is a couple of years old, based in Dubai, raised $37 million in Series A fundraising. And we covered that story. And here you are today buying a couple of companies. I'm getting there, guessing they're not unrelated. You got the war chest from the venture capital, and this is you spending it, right?
Yeah, for sure. So before we jump to this question, just giving you a quick context about Husby, because probably everyone's asking, like, what's Husby? So we are a UAE-based startup aiming to improve the home buying ecosystem. And what does it mean? We have this complex journey of home buying that starts with the search and the visits, and then we have the financing and the closing, the bureaucracy and all the paperwork. And we have to improve this ecosystem to everyone, right?
You say that, but we've got lots of prop tech companies that would claim to be doing the same thing that are very well established. If the guys from Property Finder were here, they'd be saying the same thing. If the guys from Beirut were here, they'd be saying the same thing. Hauser as well, and so on. So what is the problem there that they're not already solving?
I think everyone is trying to solve for the home buyer, but we have a different approach because we want to improve the ecosystem for everyone. So not only the home buyer, but the real estate agencies, the mortgage brokers, the banks. So it's just to connect all the dots of this complex journey. So this is what we are trying.
So at its heart, since its origins in 2020, Husby has mainly been focused on the world of home financing, or mortgages we sometimes call it. And that's why these acquisitions are in that space, just mortgages and Finance Lab as well. You also, though, have a property listings site as well. So comparisons with the big beast in the market, like the Property Finders, are inevitable. How are you going to grow and compete with them? I mean, I'm looking at the numbers on SimilarWeb, for example. Beyut.com, 37th ranked website in the country, 5.1 monthly visitors. Property Finder not far behind, 3.3 million visitors. You know, they're established, they're well-known brands. How do you compete against them?
Yeah, so you're mentioning the property portals. I think we are trying to build something different. So we are trying to build a transactional marketplace. So instead of just creating a better experience for the home search, we want to be part of the transaction. So when we talk about our main competitors here in UAE, they get the buyers directly to the real estate agencies in a batch of leads. And we want to pre-qualify this buyer. We want to have the experience in Husby's hands. So we get the buyer from the search to the closing all the way through.
It's interesting. I was writing the introduction this morning and I was thinking, is Husby a prop tech company or is it a fintech company? What would you say?
I would say we started as a fintech maybe, but we are a prop tech company. So we are getting now the real estate business in place, expanding to new countries. And we started with the mortgages. So going back to the question of the acquisitions, we became the market leaders in less than 2 years because we first acquired Home Matters, one of the market leaders back in January. And then now we have Finance Lab and Just Mortgages as well. So we can combine our tech-driven approach with the decades of experience of these market leaders. And yes, we have as well now our properties listing platform in place so we can tap the opportunity on the real estate as well and connect the dots.
And so the revenue model is, as I understand it, it's essentially you take a slice of any mortgage deals that are done through Husby. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
So you would introduce, you know, if Brandy or I were buying a home, you would introduce us to a mortgage provider. You're not lending the money, are you? But you'll introduce us to, I don't know, Dubai Islamic Bank or whoever it may be.
Yeah, exactly. But the benefit of closing with a company like Husby is that we have the tie-ups with 19 banks. So we choose what's best for the client and we don't go towards just one bank. And we have all the service free of charge for the client. We have our procurement fee from the banks. So this is how we make our revenue there in the transaction.
So what's the big picture? 5 years' time. You've done these two mortgage deals, but as you say, you're moving from being a pure play fintech to being more of a holistic prop tech type company. What's Husby going to look like in 5 years' time?
So a one-stop shop for the home buyers in which they can find their properties and finance and do all the way from search to closing with in just one place.
Regionally or globally?
Globally, I would say. We started here in UAE and then we expanded to Spain and I think we are going to move fast in Europe.
You clearly believe in it because you've moved from Brazil to join Husby, haven't you?
Yes, I did 10 months ago.
What convinced you to make the leap? Because you must, you know, big move. Anyone of us who make that move ask a lot of questions. What convinced you, yes, I'm going to do this?
I really believe in what we are building and I think we have the best talent in the world. We now have the best investors and I knew our capability of fundraising. So I really believe we are going to build something big and create a new category.
Well, wish you the best of luck with that. Those two acquisitions kicking things off with that $37 million venture capital war chest. Anna Montero is the general manager for mortgages at Husby. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Aware, as two of the Business Breakfast team, hop-off flights, and another one is potentially just hopped off a flight in the States at the other end. We are hypocritically talking about sustainable travel. Could we have done it better? There is a new sustainable travel platform getting ready to go live after getting some support from Dubai Tourism and Emirates in a new incubator. Very pleased to be joined in this studio by Jacqueline Yost, who is the founder and CEO of Ecomatic. Jacqueline, it's lovely to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you guys will be going live in October. Do you want to give us the elevator pitch?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Jacqueline. I'm the founder of Ecomatic. We're a curated marketplace for local and sustainable travel. We're featuring accommodations, experiences, shops, and eateries from around the world that are all working to make an impact. We are starting to partner with some destinations so we can adapt sustainability based off of the local market conditions and the local laws within the destination, and then do on-the-ground curation of these businesses and then launch a community hub so that travelers can really showcase, or we can showcase where travelers can make the most impact with their tourism dollars.
Why does the world need another travel platform, even a sustainable one?
Because there's just so many different green claims that are out there right now. And so it's really hard to differentiate like what's authentic and what's not. So that's really what we're doing, is just providing a platform that's only sustainable places.
Which is a really good point. How do you make sure that everyone's sustainable claims are real?
Yeah, so that's really what the importance of being here is we're doing the on-the-ground curation, and we're going into the business itself. We're meeting the founders and the business owners and walking through their environmental, socio-cultural, economic, supply chain, and future goals, and then just really ensuring that they're staying true to their claims.
Do you have criteria that people have to hit?
Yeah, so we do have a global standard that we take, looking into all the different sustainability measures that I had mentioned. And then they do have to hit a certain baseline, but we also provide the resources and the education if they're not at that point just yet.
I mean, have you had to reject people? Have you had to say to people, I'm sorry, you're not there?
Yes, we have before in the past. But it's really amazing because people who usually want to make it onto the platform are pretty motivated to do so.
So you're normally based in New York. You've got a big launch coming up in October. Why are you here?
So I was based in New York, but kind of picked up my life to come over here. I decided to come over after I made it into Intellect, which is a startup travel-related hub out here. They are partnered with Emirates, Dubai Tourism, Microsoft, and Accenture. We received a buy-in from one of their principal partners to kind of come over here, release a green guide, kind of build up a community hub out here. And so that's what made me come over here.
Okay, buy-in, technical term. What does that mean, money?
Yes, we received a grant.
What can you tell me about that grant?
We received the grant, which we're able to employ local sustainability consultants. We're also able to just kind of support us to be here. We're setting up a subsidiary company here. I was able to get an Emirates ID out of it all. So it's really just to support us in kind of like our launch and make us feel more comfortable over here.
Does that mean that you have to have more of a focus on the UAE? What are they getting from you in return for their money?
Honestly, it's not. I think that really we want to be a global company, and we really just went after a destination that would make a lot of noise. And it would also be something that most people might not necessarily think as sustainable, but we're really just trying to spotlight that sustainability can be present wherever and then be able to replicate this model in other places. Right now, we do have presence all around the world, but this is our first destination partnership. And so then we want to be able to kind of scale, and we're looking towards moving into other countries within the Middle East, as well as the US, and then expanding into other regions.
So what have you found when it comes to our green credentials? How sustainable are the businesses that are operating here?
I've been really surprised, really amazed by a lot of the businesses that I've been able to meet. A lot of people are very self-motivated because they care, and maybe that's just something that they grew up with. But that's really what we are striving to do, is just spotlight like the independent business owners who are really making like an effort just through their business operations.
And when you say business owners, I mean, this is a tourism guide, but you're going wider than hotels?
Yes. So we're featuring accommodations and experiences, shops and eateries. So the accommodations and the experiences are going to be commissionable on our platform, but we're just supporting with the restaurants and the shops to showcase that travelers can really like come full circle and make an impact wherever they're spending their tourism dollars.
Okay, you said commissionable. What's the actual business model for your website?
Yes, so we do paid partnership models, which will employ us to be on the ground and kind of curating a concentration of these types of businesses and release a green guide. But then we have a 10% commission on each booking transaction, as well as paid media.
Right, so it's not the person booking who's paying you, it is the company that is booked with.
Yes, but traditionally when someone will choose to go through like an eco label or eco certification process, it's usually paid, which creates an imbalance. So not that many people can actually go through that. But here, when we're targeting a destination and they're able to give us some funds, then we are able to do that on the ground and work with the business itself so that they're able to kind of identify as sustainable.
How do you make sure, though, that then you're not just promoting the companies that, as you say, are able to give some funds at the expense of others?
Yeah, so we only focus on local and smaller businesses. My background is in greenwashing, which is when a company will mislead on their sustainability claims for the social and the economic benefits, and then how that relates to eco-labeling and unethical online travel agency platforms. So through that, we've been able to construct a business model that makes it a lot more inclusive and environment, and also be able to support them with the education and the resources that they need.
How do you also make sure that you don't become part of the backlash that we know other travel platforms have seen for that commission? I mean, I've stayed in places where hotels have said to me, look, book directly and we will give you the same, if not a better rate, because we don't want to pay commission to the platform.
Yeah, and we really do want to try to keep money in the local economy as much as possible. So there is the option to just have like a profile onto the site. We kind of take like inspiration from TripAdvisor, where you can do like cost per clicks and all that and whatnot.
So what happens next? What needs to happen before you can launch, Jacqueline, very quickly?
Yeah, so we're going to be launching mid-October, which is really exciting. We've received investments up until this point to get our platform off the ground, but now we're looking to close our multi-million dollar seed round by October as well.
Good luck with that, Jacqueline Joost, founder and CEO of Ecomedic. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.